Welcome. I'm Harmony Slater, your host of the Finding Harmony podcast. Over the past 20 years, I've taught thousands of yoga teachers and students to explore the intersection between ancient wisdom and modern everyday life using mind-body practices to heal, awaken, and manifest their dreams from the inside out. This podcast is a sanctuary for those feeling overwhelmed by life's challenges. Are you ready to jump in and discover how these challenges aren't actually in the way, but are the way to finding harmony? Let's invite the magic back in. Hi, welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. Guess what? It's Russell's birthday coming up this week on April 22nd. So send him some birthday love. That would be great. Today we have a very special guest who is one of his old friends that he grew up with back in the good old days in Louisiana. His name is Sumanth Gopinath. And you might be wondering why we're interviewing one of Russell's old friends, not just because it's his birthday coming up, but Sumanth is an incredibly interesting human. He's a professor of music and also a musician who plays grassroots folk music from America. And so we are talking today about the exchange between India and North America, similarities, differences in Indian music versus folk music, and how both of his parents were born in India and how they came to America and how he grew up in the USA and some of his experiences growing up. So it's a deep dive into culture and cultural exchange. So if you're a lover of nuance and learning and culture, this is going to be a conversation that you will absolutely love. Sumanth and his music are really fun, really beautiful, and I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. It's a full class and composition on music history, as well as the history of India, and how it all ties back and relates to folk music in North America, and even Russell's own experience of growing up in Louisiana and also being a Westerner who's very much interested in India and Indian culture, adopting many practices from India and learning in India for many, many years. So it's going to be interesting. So let's jump in and get going. Welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. Hey, how are you doing, Sumanth?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Such a pleasure.
This is surreal, to be sure. I have an introduction that I'd like to read for our listeners. We have a large Swedish population that listens to the show, and they may not know your work, so I'm just going to...
Okay.
Our esteemed guest, Sumanth Gopinath, is Associate Professor of Music Theory. He is the author of The Ringtone Dialectic, Economy and Cultural Form. He co-edited with Jason...
Stanyek,
the Oxford Handbook of Mobile Music Studies, and Rethinking Praik with, I cannot pronounce that name.
Quick Option.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
that's a tough one.
His writings on Steve Reich, musical minimalism, Marxism, and music scholarship, the Nike Plus Sport Kit, the ringtone industry, Bob Dylan, and Benjamin Britten have appeared in various scholarly journals and edited collections. He is working on a book project on musical minimalism and is conducting research on sound and new and formerly new media, Bob Dylan's musicianship, the aesthetics of smoothness, and the music of the Scottish, the Scottish composer James Dillon. He is the leader of the independent Americana band, The Gated Community, and you and I went to high school together.
That's right. We go back a long way. Over 30 years, right?
It's now going on 32, because we met when we were 14.
Yeah.
We met in Mrs. Moore's AP English class when we were 14, maybe 15.
I mean, 30, we're talking 34 years, right?
34 years.
30 to 34 years, yeah.
Yeah. I feel personally very privileged to have had your friendship. I was something less civilized than feral at that time. And I feel like you were very patient with me, extraordinarily patient. And I just want to say how much I appreciate the kindness. And I mean that because I was not a pleasant person. And I just...
Very, really?
Not no, pleasant? Very, yeah.
This is a long thing and it's hard. It's complicated to talk about, but Russ and I have been dear friends for a long time. And so I think... In those years, it was really a product of moving to Louisiana from the Chicago area and really not having like a network and fitting into that kind of world that I was inserted into. And there was a lot of bullying, you know, a lot of people in those classes I was in, Russ participated in it, was part of the experience. And I've spent a lot of time like thinking about that stuff and going through various phases with it. Originally, I was just like hurt and upset. And then when I went away to this school that was a boarding school, like a boarding magnet school, but a public school. So it was very affordable. It was like $500 a year or something, called the Louisiana School for Maths, Science, and Arts. And Roz actually came with me to my graduation. And what happened was that school really transformed my sense of self. And I felt much more kind of accepting of the fact that I was a smart kid. I was a musician. I think consciousness of my racial identity came later, but it was more implicitly there in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back and visited, I just felt very differently about a lot of it. And I think it was really that last summer, that summer and maybe spring of my senior year, that I got in touch with Russ again. And I can't remember exactly the context.
I do. You came to a musical performance or some kind of event at Slidell High, and you came in and you were rocking this shaggy black hair and a beard. And I remember we made eye contact and something lit up, like this kind of the sense of namaskara. We saw something in each other and we both lit up at the same time and initiated a friendship. And I remember the moment exactly, because it had been difficult before that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's good. See, my memory is terrible. So I tend to remember like certain moments and flashes and images and feelings, but precise memories have never been great for me. And so it's nice to hear that. Then I do remember that we hung out a lot. Well, you came to the graduation, I think. We spent a lot of time listening to Phish. That was part of the whole getting to be friends. And
Your whole bluegrass second set was a thing that excited about. Yeah.
Yeah. They're covering the White Album and the things that we did. Yeah. And then Russ mentioned that recording we made. So my brother and I had been making these various kinds of song recordings at our house, and Russ joined us with one of them, the one called Tree Monkey.
I have that here, actually, if you can hear this.
1, 2, 3, 4. A.M., I hate the alarm. I got to find work, oh well. Jump in the sea, a tree monkey. Ride mango in the tree monkey. Licking his palms in the sun.
It is ridiculous.
It sounds good.
It's a ridiculous song. That was the only time in my life I've ever tried to be a musician, because I'm not good at that. But one thing that was happening was just how much learning I was receiving from you guys, like learning about Rachmaninoff or counterpoint, or listening to the way that you listened to music. You know, we'd listen to the White Album or listen to Jimi Hendrix together. And like the little subtleties that Shimin, your brother, would mention about music, like, do you hear what he's doing there? It created the capacity for learning about music that I hadn't had to that point. And there's another event that happened that also became a kind of a touchstone for leaping off. In your house, I was watching the Bulls play the Knicks in like a playoff game. and I was a passionate Bulls follower, and I got really upset, and I took something and I threw it against the wall, if you remember. And afterward, I calmed down, and I think even like the next day, I apologized to you about throwing things in your parents' house. And you said, no, it's okay. This is the kind of thing that I think that you would probably do in your own home. You had so much tolerance and compassion and patience. And it was almost something you could describe as anti-cultural to my experience as an American, to be that generous and understanding of the other. And I feel like that kind of thought style was something that was so foundational to Harmony and I in our understanding and our study of yoga and yoga practice and the Yoga Sutra. Patanjali was just to trying to see the self in the other as something unified rather than separate. But when I was thinking back on our relationship and I was thinking back on that particular moment, it was like, oh, that's the first time I ever encountered that.
There's so much here to unpack. It's really interesting. First of all, I mean, both of you know much more in many ways about facets of Indian culture than I know or will ever know, right? I mean, my experiences in relationship to it are complicated and partial because I grew up in the US and most of my work and thinking are not oriented around India. And so that's fascinating to me. I mean, when I think of self and other, I think of also aspects of Western philosophy, and Levinas's work in particular was someone really preoccupied with the other and the trying to reconcile the relationship of the self to other. I mean, there's a long history in Western philosophy of thinking about those things in various ways. And the Hegelian lineage or tradition is one that I come from because it flows into Marx and I'm a Marxist. And so those things like end up being important to the way I think about a lot of things. But obviously they appear in different places, right? And in different variants or flavors or what have you. But I was thinking about that moment and trying to reconstruct it in my mind. Was it, we were watching the TV, we must have been in the living room. And I think, did you throw something at the brick wall with the fireplace?
Possibly.
And I think about it too. That moment, I'm sure it would have depended on what it was that you threw and where you threw it, right? Yeah. And had you thrown something that shattered and broke, I probably would have been more upset or concerned. So these things are all, you were also a new friend and I was also trying. I mean, in general, I'm pretty accepting, tolerant person, but it's so many of these things are so like context dependent and specific as to how they unfold. But that's not to say, though, that aspects of Hindu philosophy and culture and thinking, they were all around me in various ways because of my parents. And then in a different way, because of these comic books that I know that we showed you, they're called Amar Chitrakatha. And there's this kind of post-independence project that ended up kind of being an interest in among both diasporic Indians as well as Indians in India, reading about, in a kind of loosely Hindu-centric, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are both like represented in it. We had a bunch of them.
I purchased my own copies, actually.
Oh, nice. I mean, I think they're kind of amazing, but they're also like the Indian leftists are critical, which, they should be or whatever. But it's one of these things to think about, that these post-independence projects that balance the politics of having a Hindu majority with the kind of ecumenical, discourse and imaginary, which historically is kind of baked into or part of Hinduism, which isn't a single thing. I mean, what is it? It's like, it's a bunch of stuff. And then was written into the post-independence constitution. And so that's the India that I sort of believe in and like. And the current India is the India of, Hindutva and basically fascism, which we have our own version of here. I mean, you're in Canada, right? I'm in the US, and the US is here. And
many parts of Canada would love to be in the United States
and settle Canada,
participate in this fascist theocracy. They would love that.
The trucker. I remember the truckers, the moment, which was a special Canadian moment. But it feels like we're right now like sleepwalking into authoritarianism because people are frustrated with Joe Biden, Democrats, and inflation, whatever. These things are all frustrating. And so anyway, these kinds of questions around my background are like filtered through and meet now like my later political awareness that developed, you know, in graduate school and becoming involved in labor activism, which I still have a hand in today. And so, yeah, anyway, all of which is to say that to see something of Hindu philosophy in my childhood is super fascinating because I think it's there. And at the same time, it's also, there are other things there too, right? So, yeah.
The word that would come up for me was, it would be something like samskara, which is the inherited patterns of belief and action. And what I inherited was a cycle of violence and alcoholism. And almost like maybe some Lutheran tenets in there somewhere, but like not really lived. So my pattern of behavior is entering this kind of wonderful world that I was invited into with your father, who was a nice man, which I'm not sure I'd ever met before. And
that's right. Yeah.
He was like a nice, upstanding man, very interested in our health and in your health and our development. And your mother, who was my algebra teacher, who was also teaching me how to cook, like a kind of family that was so far removed from my experiences as to be on another planet. So now I'm bathing in your family's pattern and behavior, and it is fundamentally different for me, but
that's awesome.
Fascinating. Yeah. And then I went to Chicago, and I didn't realize that you were from Chicago. Were you born there?
Yeah, I was born in Chicago Heights, and we were in the Homewood Flossmoor area for 9 years before we moved to Slidell. So I went and saw recently, this would have been summer of last year, I think we did a drive from Minneapolis down to Slidell to see my parents. And I think the first two summers after the pandemic, we did that. I guess we're still in it, but it's anyway, whatever, how you wanted to talk about it is complicated. But we drove down, and on the way back, we decided to stop by the house. And that was the house that my father, he general contracted and built. And it's in a neighborhood called Elysian Fields.
Yeah, I know that.
What I was struck by was that the neighborhood was now largely an upper middle class African American neighborhood, whereas before it was racially whiter. But it was interesting because it was, I don't know if the combination of race and class and the geography and the patterns there had anything to do with it, but it looks basically like it did when I was there growing up. So there were a few differences. My dad built the house very near to the train station because he wanted to take the train into work as a commuter. His dad was a chief railway engineer in India in both during the late colonial and then independence era. And so trains were part of his life. He has this whole like transit thing. He did grew up with the trains thing. He was on ships in the British Merchant Navy in the 1960s. And then he went to work at Pullman, where he was helping to design these trailmobile train cars. And then when they went out of business, he had another job. And then when he moved to Louisiana, he took the job that a lot of people in Slidell had, which was working at the Martin Marietta plant, building the external tank of the space shuttle. Right? There were a lot of NASA people.
Yeah, there were. And Tammany especially.
Exactly.
And that must be when he started picking up all of these railroad songs and country and western. The country western experience is the railroad, isn't it?
Maybe. I mean, I will say this, which is that PR bit is a little exaggerated. Our press person wrote that up to say that I was influenced by my dad's classic country.
Really?
Collection. I mean, it's not untrue, but I would say it would be country folk. So there were certain country songs that he loved. Like he loved Hank Williams's Jambalaya, and we listened to that a lot. He loved Tennessee Ernie Ford's 16 Tons. We listened to that a lot. And then he loved like more folk revival-y stuff. Tom Dooley, you know, the Kingston Trio, the Brothers Four, that kind of stuff. So I would say country was part of this picture of, you know, Western vernacular popular music that he was interested in. And we did listen to those things, but it wasn't like a collection.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But in retrospect, that was an interesting influence to go back and reflect on.
Yeah. It's interesting to have to come over from India and then to have Indian music, which is very, very different.
Yeah.
And like
extremely
using like semitones and I don't know, quarter tones and 1/8 tones and all the different tones.
Yes.
And like different scales than we even have in Western music, but then for him to so like find an adoration or a connection, like a soul connection with country western music. But then like for you too, yeah, to be, like you said, growing up in the West and in a very Western way, but there's all these subtle kind of still subtle cultural influences because it's just the water you swim in.
Yeah, completely. Right. Yeah. I mean, the way I talk is influenced by being a South Asian American. I mean, I often think about my accent as something that is influenced by my own singing and in country Western style music. And I definitely have speech patterns that are characteristic of South Asian Americans. I don't have a typical St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana accent because I moved there when I was 9, and Shamin, my brother, and I, we made this pact with each other that we were not going to talk like that. But that was a thing we said, we explicitly said when I was 9 and he was 7. But, you know, I think it creeps in at the edges in various ways. But yeah, and I would say in terms of music, yes, I mean, very much, and culturally, you know, many aspects of my upbringing were very Indian. I mean, we had these monthly pujas that we would go to and do. We had, sometimes they were at our house. We did, in fact, that fireplace was the kind of makeshift altar, and people would kind of gather around that and set up this like ganpati and all this stuff. And so,
it's just so bizarre that I ended up wedding as a pujari and led puja. And, you know, I had my own kind of Vedavyasa that I would do puja to. And it's an interesting arc that the two of us have, because I thought you were going to become a classical pianist.
Right.
And you went to Yale to study music, as I understand. And, you know, I know that you'd studied electrical engineering at University of Texas. There's all these beautiful, like, triple helixes through our life where we keep intersecting, and we keep, as Harmony might say, there's a karmic connection that we can't unwind.
And we're stuck with each other.
We're stuck with each other. And I would have thought you would have gone off to study, and yet you do study and write about classical composition, but you are a bluegrass musician of Americana music, and I'm now a retired yoga teacher.
Slash retired pujari.
I'm retired. Yeah. I still have this stuff. I can get it out.
Yeah, I do. I want to hear more about the retirement, but I have to say, but to step back, it is funny that Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy movie Trading Places comes to mind many times.
Does.
But I will say that, in terms of my trajectory, it was still very shaped by some of the concerns that immigrant families and South Asian American, upwardly mobile, middle class families have. And that, to step back from what I'm about to say, also shapes our interactions, right, as kids, which is that, one, on the one hand, we were a non-white family and your family was white. But on the other hand, we were economically class relatively more stable than your household. And so I think class plays a big role in like the way that we interacted, and especially then when you came to be participating in our household, hanging out and stuff. Like, part of what you saw was also the kind of, you know, the inheritances of relative class privilege. You saw relative also just cultural privilege. I mean, my family is not a wealthy family. And in Illinois, actually, even though we were never poor, my father struggled a lot because he was meeting this wave of U.S. deindustrialization that was central to what was happening in a lot of manufacturing industries at that time. And so he kept being laid off because of major economic shifts. And so things were dodgy economically when we were in Illinois. And when he made it to Louisiana, economically, things really firmed up. And there was a whole process of basically getting themselves out of debt and like getting to a kind of economic stability that they'd never had. And I would say the trade-off, here's another interesting trade-off, is that socioculturally, Illinois was very peaceful for me. I mean, I had, you know, this is often the case as you're younger and you enter adolescence and all the hormones and all the shit of that, you know, sort of those years of growing up come to a head. Those weren't there. But I would say I had no sense of like discrimination or anything. Like, I just did not, it felt like placid and peaceful. Yeah. And there were other kids of various ethnic backgrounds in my schools. And so it was when I got to Louisiana that then people started asking me these questions about who are you, where are you from? They had trouble pronouncing my name. And I'm sure they did in Illinois, and I just don't remember. But there was attempts like early on to try to convert me or threaten me, saying, you know, I'm going to hell because I'm not a Christian. Jesus Christ is not my Lord and Savior. Like that stuff was there. And then the kind of middle school through early high school sort of bullying stuff, which had just that alone is just there are so many layers to that experience. And then Louisiana school, which was a whole different Louisiana and a kind of its own sort of utopian one, which was really powerful, like I was mentioning. And then Texas, right? I was in Texas for 5 years. So I had this whole like sojourn in the South, and I still think of myself as a Southerner. But that kind of, that kind of class experience shaped a lot. And it's whatever class, racial, regional experience shaped me a lot. And because of that sort of cultural privilege that you encountered, my parents, even though they're not wealthy, as I was trying to unfold back, they were very culturally privileged. They're a Brahmin caste, Maharashtrian Brahmins. My father's father was a chief engineer in the railway, these railway colonies in the south of India. He was like living like royalty. And then my mom's father was a founder of one of the Indian Institutes of Technology and a president of multiple ones. These were like very powerful people. Mm-hmm. And my parents were sort of not powerful, not as high accomplishing people from these powerful families, which is also interesting.
But that often happens, right? When families have to change countries or choose to change countries, you often lose a lot of
inherited wealth.
Yeah, inherited wealth or status as far as economic status, because you have to start over literally in a new country.
That's totally right. And so what they had was a kind of set of expectations, sort of cultural practices, behaviors, beliefs, knowledge that then met this new relative lack of privilege born of immigrant experience. And so anyway, all of those things shaped what I did when I went to school, which was to be a good Indian boy and study engineering, even though I was not very good at fixing or doing anything like that. And I did fine. I aced the degree, but I didn't really learn a whole lot. I learned some things, and I feel like I still think about it in certain ways. I use engineering more doing music than anything else. And then when I went to study music, it was still with a practical bent. And this is to get back now several layers back to Russ's question, which is that there was, you know, what was I doing? A part of me definitely wanted to be a classical pianist, and I was studying and playing very seriously at that time, but I wasn't good enough. Like I would say if I had been trained better, I would have had better technique and better teachers who focused on the physiological facets of pedagogy. Maybe I would have had a shot. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not convinced my body could have done it. Or if I had to, I would have had to really thought differently about how to use my body. Mm-hmm. So when I went to Texas, I actually got tendonitis in my right arm. And so I had to play left-hand pieces for about a year, which was interesting. And then, you know, I built back up, and I just never practiced at the depth or scale that I did before then. And I was practicing wrongly. This is also probably entirely germane to the kinds of things you've done as yoga teachers, but right? But so that
is exactly what we were thinking. Yeah. And I'm sure we were both chomping at the bit to talk about it.
So be curious to hear about that. So that experience quickly made me realize, you know, I mean, I have some talent and I still do play classical piano, but I realized that there were going to be limitations based on the trajectory I'd taken. And so given that, what could I do? And I wanted to do music, and the sort of paths that were available for someone like me would have been composition or academic music study. And the way that I experienced or encountered composition and academic music study at Texas really shaped that. Because it was the people who were teaching music theory who were really inspiring to me. And the composers were less so. There was one I encountered later, Russell Pinkston, who taught electroacoustic music, and I really liked him. But I also had friends who were composers. In fact, one of my college dorm mates and still very long-standing friend, Trevor Bacha, who actually graduated from the Honors Liberal Arts program that Gabrielle, my ex-wife, went into.
Also went to high school with us.
She also went to high school, And
who I also bullied.
Yeah, he did. And this is a painting of hers, actually. Went from
is it
years,
really?
Yeah. She did these amazing paintings. She's still, so we're still close.
She went to Yale for painting, right?
She went to RISD for painting.
Oh, RISD.
And then went to Yale for a PhD in art history. And now she and her husband teach in Humboldt County in northern California.
Really?
And so her husband is an artist and teaches at Humboldt State, and she teaches at College of the Redwoods or something. Anyway,
so by county decree, you have to also have a marijuana farm. That's
right. She's talked a lot about that facet of that world. Yeah, really interesting. Anyway, so this program, which my friend Trevor went into, he's a wonderful composer and friend. So because of his experience, I think I was skeptical of what it would mean to compose. And then here's the other key piece of this, was that by the end of my degree, everyone, my brother, Gabrielle, my other best friend from college, Rohit Prasankumar.
I remember.
You remember.
Over my place as drummer, as I remember.
Yes, that's right. Yes, he did.
And, he was and much better, I imagine.
He is a good drummer. So anyway, all of them were saying, you should go into music. This is what you want to do. And so I started researching job placement rates, and music theory actually had high placement rates. And I've only more recently really clearly figured out why, which was essentially that music theorists, the creation of the professional music theorist, which is what my job is, was predicated essentially on professionalizing aspects of the music curriculum theory teaching, which had traditionally been done by other people because there was no professional music theorist. There were music theory pedagogues, people sort of specialized in this kind of teaching. There were composers. Many composers ended up doing this kind of work. And then there were historical musicologists, and other performers would do it. And this creation of this new profession, which sort of created this much more research-driven sort of approach to the field, ended up being part of a kind of post-World War II movement that really took off in the 50s and 60s, and the formation of the Society for Music Theory was formed in 1978. And so one of the people I encountered there at Texas was Patrick McCralis. He taught this summer class on 20th century music theory that I was sitting in on for fun. And I just found it really easy. And I knew the repertoire because I listened to a lot of classical music at that point. And Pat was just encouraging. And so I thought, this is cool. I'll keep doing this music theory thing. And that's how I got into it. And by the time when I was thinking, what am I going to do? I saw these placement rates and I thought, this is a viable path for me. But it really was predicated, again, on this kind of creation of this profession and essentially stealing jobs from other people, most of whom would have been composers. And so I published an article on this like earlier this year, like what the political economy of our field is. So anyway, it's really interesting. So that's a big part of how I ended up where I am.
I was just thinking, like, for those listening, we all kind of know what a composer is, someone who writes music. We know what a musician is, someone who plays music. I think we can figure out what a music historian is, someone who looks at the history of music. But what does a yoga theorist do?
Music theorist.
A music theorist. Yeah, I said yoga theorist.
Yeah, I like it.
What does a music theorist do? So maybe we can become yoga theorists.
Well, they're probably related, but I would say this is a thing that's worth unpacking, and I'll try to do it efficiently. Essentially, the way music theorists define what they do is that they're the people who teach the structure of music, how music works. And so when you take a class from a music theorist, you're not necessarily focusing on the historical context of what a composer or creator does, but you're really thinking about how do they do what they do, and that these kinds of patterns of doing have maybe broader historical trajectories and practices and traditions you're participating in. Russell mentioned earlier counterpoint. That's the art of writing lines against other lines. So you have a melodic line that may be in an upper register, and then you have to write a melodic line that goes with it at the lower register. And so you would teach students how to do this. There would be like practices and rules based on the traditions of teaching this kind of thing that go back to really like the 15th century, I think. And so this kind of history of teaching these traditions and practices of how to make music, and really we're talking about Western classical music, that's what it was originally, that's typically what music theorists do. So when you take a class with a music theorist historically, you would take classes in harmony. Mm-hmm. You learn about chords and about how they work and sequence, the kind of grammar and organizing of them. And you would have very limited sort of sets of exercises you would do to try to compose and write out those chords according to sort of rules like in exercises. And so there's a kind of like math problem-like element to it, but it's also an aesthetic thing because you want it to sound good and there are certain criteria for what sounds good. And so that's like you build up this kind of skill set over several semesters and then you start studying advanced techniques. Like counterpoint would be a more advanced thing, studying analytical methods for music that doesn't use traditional chords and in fact uses different kinds of sort of bases for the music. What we call post-tonal theory. We're not going to get into the term, but that would be another kind of more advanced thing. And then specialist courses based on more research-driven things. And some of music theory gets very mathematical because there are people using various kinds of mathematics to understand sort of fundamental properties of music given certain assumptions. Some music theory focuses on music psychology and cognition. So they'll do lab studies and PET scan studies, more abstract research based on psychology. That's a whole other, music cognition is another area. There are people who do the history of music theory because this practice has a long history. And so they study that and we're required to learn that in grad school. And then there are other areas of focus, whether you're focusing on sort of music in this sort of general chord-based era and techniques used to analyze it, music that's sort of past that, and then other techniques or other questions, like how do music theorists talk about rhythm and meter, or how do music theorists talk about timbre, how music sounds, like how sounds sound. And so all of these sorts of different kinds of ways into questions around music have opened up a field over the last maybe three decades. So music theory started out as a very sort of tradition-oriented thing. It became research-driven much more in the mid-20th century. And then through that research-driven process, whole avenues of exploration really opened up. And so there's this kind of divide between what a music theorist researches, which is often technical or very specific, and then something that would be often very basic, like I'm teaching people to read music or spell chords or write key signatures. So that's the recent history of how music theory has tended to go. However, because of many developments in the field and society, including George Floyd's murder, made a huge impact on the field as it did in so many facets of, you know, North America and
global. Especially there in Minneapolis.
Yeah, exactly. And that has really pushed the field to become much more critical of the fact that we've basically been promoting and advocating for, whether implicitly or explicitly, just Western classical music and white composers and male composers.
Yeah. 17th century European composers is what we call classical music.
Yeah, 17th and mainly 18th and 19th century. Yeah. And so those are the kind of like preferred things to study. And now the field has really shifted a lot. So a lot of people are writing about popular music and teaching it. And they're writing about music of the Black diaspora much more. Jazz studies has become much more central to the field. And there were people doing some of these things decades ago too, but they were much more in the minority. Now these are much more the kind of majority conversations. So it's interesting. And because I have my hand in lots of things, and I'm also one of the few non-white music theorists, that's another thing. It's a very male, very white field, which is one of the anxieties of the field is to try to diversify itself. And that has been one of the motivations as to like, how do we do that? On part, we need to embrace lots of different kinds of musics. If we're music theorists, we really should be theorists of any kind of music in principle. And then we have to develop the expertise necessarily to figure out how to talk about it. And I would say my own take on this whole thing is that I've long been dubious of music theory. That music theory, there are some facets of it that really are very specialized, especially the kind of math and cognition stuff. There absolutely should be a place for it. I'm not opposed to the existence of the field or anything. But in other parts of the world, especially in Europe and Asia, Latin America, places where there are Western European classical music style traditions that are pretty strong, music theory isn't separated from historical musicology. So people who do the history of music also do the theory of music together. And my preference is to keep them together. Like for me, history really matters. Marxists really care about history. And so for me, like my approach has always been a kind of blend of theory-driven analysis where I'm informed by the recent methods and theory to analyze or talk about specific pieces of music or songs. But then I'm also situating them in historical context and often making political and economic arguments about it. And so my approach has much more been a kind of cultural studies meets like the kind of blend of music fields rather than this hyper technical sort of approach to music. Although some of my stuff is still more technical because I am interested in these technical details, but I'm more interested in them, not for their own sake, but because I think when you delve into the details, you get a richer sense of how it means and how it works. And this is another big thing for me, the meaning, like how to interpret it, the way that literary critics and art historians routinely talk about meaning. It's not an issue or like a kind of a hang up that they have. But in music scholarship, it's a hang up. Like people have long debated these questions. Does music mean? Can we talk about its meaning? Is it really just ineffable? And these debates keep surfacing and keep circulating and cycling. They have for centuries now. And it's strange. Music is abstract in many ways. It's weird, but it's also super tangible. It's also tied when you're tied to genres and you're accessing sounds. It's also a kind of means of appropriation to get into some of the things we were thinking about prior to this conversation. Yeah, like I said, I knew this could happen. We could really talk for hours and hours, I'm sure. But anyway, that concreteness of music's meaning is, I think, one of the things that I think this conversation sometimes doesn't emphasize enough. And so a lot of my teaching focuses on that. And I teach courses on popular music. I have a newer course I've been teaching on country music analysis. I have taught a class on Bob Dylan. I've taught classes on more traditional sonata analyses. Influenced by some of my teachers. I teach a class called Music and Meaning, which really focuses specifically on this kind of question that we're talking about now. And my approach to theory has been this kind of blend essentially of the historical and the more abstract, because I think they work better when you think of them together.
It's fascinating, and I know it's completely off what we were going to talk about, but you go to Yale and you initiate a student revolt against the authorities there, and
I didn't initiate it, but I was part of it. Yeah.
But you could say that, yeah, a far right radio announcer might call it a radicalization of your views. And at the same time, you become a folk musician. And I have this image in my mind of Woody Guthrie with a guitar, "This machine kills fascists." And there's all sorts of wrongheaded thinking in that description. But I wonder if you could jump into what happened that when you went from Texas to Yale, that all of these, you know, very transformative things started to happen for you.
Yeah, this is a great question. And it really is one of the defining turning points in my life. I would say one of them was moving to Louisiana, complicated, mixed feelings about it, but definitely a major turning point. Second one would have been going to that school, that Louisiana school, which saved my life in some ways. I feel like without that school, I don't know what I would be as a person. And then the third one would have been going to Yale and encountering these remarkable, essentially remarkable social movement. And I was very apolitical, or at least my politics were only instinctive. And my parents are liberal Democrats, which itself was far to the left of the people that were around them. I would say the edge towards socialist. Not quite there, maybe, but pretty close.
The number of people that we went to school with that voted for David Duke was something like 60%, 40%.
And my dad always talks about this. At the time, he said there was this bumper sticker going around, which it said, "Vote for the crook. It matters." Because who was running against David Duke was Edwin Edwards, the former governor, who was already convicted of racketeering and had done jail time, I think.
He just got out of prison,
right? Yeah. And so I think this kind of thing, what they were much more politically aware and savvy than I was. I really didn't think about it. But when I got to Yale, what happened was that a classmate in the music department, in my first semester there, asked me, "So do you want to join the union?" And I thought, sure, I'll join the union. I had no idea what that meant, but I thought, sure. You know, I mean, I had some vague sense of like labor unions and the workers or whatever. And so I thought, sure, I'll do that thing. I don't know what that means. But over the course of that year, I basically started doing under this classmate. Her name's Allison Nowicki. Anyway, she basically was encouraging me to just, you know, like if there are things that are wrong that you want to fix, you should fix them or work on fixing them. And so one of the things that happened was that there was a requirement, an implicit requirement, that in the summer after your second year, you needed to stay in town and study for your qualifying exams, which you would take at the end of that summer. And then at the beginning of that next semester, you would go into teaching. That was the pattern there. And I think it's still there. The thing that was frustrating was that we weren't paid very well to go. The stipends at that time, this late 90s, were $10,000 a year, just low. Even then it was low, but we did receive benefits, healthcare. There were other things that we got. And that was already the product of an earlier phase of this labor struggle on campus that it didn't, I was starting to learn about. Before then, I think the year I got there was the first year of this, where everyone had $10,000 and $10,500, I think it was, and healthcare. Prior to that, it was students. I think the stipend was a quarter of the students got $8,000. And with that tuition, I also had tuition covered. A quarter got $4,000 and tuition covered. A quarter just got tuition covered, and a quarter had to pay for everything. And that's a lot of money. Even then, it was a lot. At that time, it would have been $20,000, $30,000 a year. Now it's over $50,000. And it was a lot. That experience then didn't cover enough for the summer. So a lot of people have to take summer jobs. And I said, if you're expecting people to study for these exams, you should provide some funding for them. Yale is a very rich institution. You can find funding for them. And it turned out that there were funds available to do other things that we'd been receiving money for, including language study, which I took advantage of my first summer. And Gabrielle and I went to Germany and we were there for a summer and I learned German. That's how I know German. That's the only really non-English language that I know pretty well, I would say. Anyway, and so that experience, like knowing that was there and knowing that these students were basically taking out loans to be there, I thought this is unfair. It's one thing if it were a context without money, but Yale has a lot of money. Even then, they had billions and billions of dollars in their endowment. So I thought they can afford this. So we wrote a letter up, we signed it. The students had big meetings with the faculty, and they did. The faculty actually did find, I think, $500 for students. And then that money ended up going up over the time I was there. But that made me realize that, oh, collective action can change things for the better. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge lesson. And that's really what I came to realize, oh, there's something important about this, which is you're not just doing this yourself, you're doing it with others. And that collective thinking, which I think I've always been a very social person, so I was inclined to it, but I didn't think of being social as a political thing. And then being social is a political thing when we act in concert. And so then through that, I decided I'm going to become a union organizer. And then through that, I met all these students in other fields. And then through that, I started sitting in on these reading groups on philosophy. And then I encountered Michael Denning, who is still a mentor and one of my heroes and teacher. He was on my dissertation committee. He was teaching these reading groups or leading reading groups on Marx and Capital and the Grundrisse, which is the kind of draft for Capital. And those were just transformative. I thought, wow, this stuff is hard. It's really interesting. I feel like it's giving me a purchase on the world that I'd not had before. And that really is what it was, the combination of the reading and the thinking and being active in a political movement, which that was what changed it. And the organizers were extraordinary. They were just so committed. There were people who were taking a lot of time out of their day to go and meet other people, have these coffee meetings and try to like make the case for why a union matters and to really listen to what people's fears and concerns were and to be a good listener. And they didn't always get it right, but I think no one ever does. But on balance, they did an incredible thing. And actually, just within the last couple of days, the union, after 30 something years of struggling, was finally recognized earlier this year. They won an election and then they just finished negotiating their contract like in the last day or two. And it's a huge set of raises and benefits for grad employees. So it was a privilege to be part of that effort. And it changed the way I thought about so many things. And that I would say that third kind of development really, set the stage for so much of my academic writing.
When I think of the socialist movement in the United States, I feel like it's so often tied to the music that was coming out to celebrate the movement, celebrate the union. Woody Guthrie, it seems like a great example. Did you feel that the development for you in becoming a folk musician was also very much tied into, forgive the expression if this is offensive, but the radicalization that you were developing, a burgeoning kind of political consciousness? Do you feel like those were very tied together? Because they also both of these seem tied to your encounter with Louisiana.
Yeah, they are. I think they were. It didn't work like that in the sense that my political awareness didn't then result in me thinking I'm going to write and participate in this tradition in a direct way. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember, because I'd also, over the years of being in Texas and then initially at Yale, I had stopped doing a lot of the vernacular pop rock stuff that we were doing, you know, in high school. And
no more Tree Monkeys.
No more Tree, right. Which was, that was totally like a satire. I mean, we were kind of imitating the Police. I was doing Sting voice, Sting himself satirizing, appropriating these Jamaican voices. So the whole thing was a joke, right? We were kind of satirizing a lot of these groups. And in fact, a lot of those tapes are us making fun of other groups, whether it's U2 or Morrissey or whatever.
I remember you telling me at the time, like, why are we doing a Sting song when you hate Sting so much? I don't know. I hate Sting, and yet we're doing a Sting song.
Right. I liked it at the time. I had mixed feelings about it.
We took it to a radio station. We liked it so much.
Right. That's right. And, you know, over the years, I've had my ups and downs with Sting.
Also an Ashtanga yoga practitioner.
Yes, he is. That's right. Wow. But anyway, and so we ended up kind of...
Meeting Sting at a party was surreal, because looking right at him, remembering Tree Monkey. And I also felt like he looked at me with contempt at the same...
He was like,
I don't trust you. Wow. Anyway. I mean, I often have this debate with our mastering engineer about... It's this running joke now about who's worse, Sting or U2 or Sting or Bono. And his take, he's a very funny guy. I was just emailing him earlier today. He says, Bono's political crimes may be worse, but Sting's musical crimes are probably far worse. And which I think he's probably right about. It's very funny. Anyway, so this was the kind of stuff that was in the background when I thought, well, I'll try to make political songs. And really, by that point, I was so influenced by like a lot of funk music. When I was returning to vernacular music, it was through Black music, and it was particularly through like funk and soul. Curtis Mayfield was a huge presence for me. And so I was writing these kind of Curtis Mayfield, Al Green style stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't really sing like that. And so that was also always a problem. I felt like I love this music, but I can't really sing like this, or this, my voice isn't doing what I want it to do in that way. And so I always felt this tension. And so what happened was that in 2003, Gabrielle's classmate in art history came over. He and his wife came over to our place for dinner, and he asked, would you like to join my country band? It was kind of like the union thing. I thought, sure, I'll join your country band. I had no idea what that meant, again, except that I hated country music in my mind or whatever.
Yeah.
Although I had been primed by the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, which I think
that was
transformative for lots of people, right? People who were into country and bluegrass and old time prior to that resent like the latecomers or whatever. And I was one. I definitely was. Yeah. But it's great musicians doing great music. And I thought, this is wonderful stuff. And then when Rob came along, I thought, yeah, I'll try it. And he made these incredible mixtapes for us. And Rob was also part of like our whole group of Marxists doing the Marxist reading. So like he was very much part of the circle that we were in. And so he gave me these mixtapes, and you know, they had Merle Haggard and the Flatlanders and Terry Allen and all these people. And I thought, and Michael Hurley was such a big influence for me. I thought, this stuff is incredible. What was I missing? Like, I just didn't know how good this music was.
Right.
And then I started writing country songs, and I started singing them. And in singing and writing them, I felt for the first time, I am writing music that feels like I feel really good about doing this. Like it's not a joke or satire only. I mean, there were joke satire elements, but it was also something else. And there was something real about that moment. There was something that it sort of fused with all of the anxiety and weird feelings I had about growing up in Louisiana and Slidell and what it meant to be from the South, but in the North, and then also being South Asian, which was like, you know, and the like racial politics of all this, like it all came together in this very surprising way, writing these songs. And I still remember that first song I wrote was called On the Same Train. And I played it on my piano, that grand piano my parents still have. And I recorded it. And I remember, and I still think that's a decent song. And I remember showing it to Rob, and he was surprised. He thought, wow, this is a good song. Like you want to do this thing. And then we started writing songs. I kind of unleashed this torrent of songs. And yeah, that was a huge moment. And then of course, all of the politics and the thinking came into the writing, what we were writing about. The first songs I was writing, the one that we used to do a lot was Spy Camera. And of course it was about the NSA and about all the sort of like surveillance state things. There was one called Stephen Thomas Erlewine, which was one that was written about the All Music Guide editor and writer, Tom Erlewine. He lives in Austin, Texas. He actually doesn't know that I've written this song about him, but he's heard the song and he just creeped out by it later. And I think that's really funny. But it was actually kind of a tribute to him. But the basic story is that someone's kind of like, you know, plugged into the machine being forced to write reviews of all the music. And so it's this sort of, again, satire slash, you know, morality tale.
That's such a beautiful way of describing that moment when you wrote that music. In the way you describe it, what I'm hearing is a passionate investment.
Yes.
And the question I want to ask you about this topic, because it's something that's, it's just, it's exploding through our yoga community right now, is what separates someone who is an authentic practitioner from an appropriator? And so often it's dictated by your cultural experience, which is to say your skin color. Yep. And so what I'm so excited about is, like, when is this moment, and is it possible? Is actual learning possible, is the question. And when does something that you pick up that's foreign to you become learned and real?
My position on this is not the typical position, which is appropriation is part of what humans do, right? We mimic and copy each other all the time. And when we're faced with doing so in a cross of cultural boundaries that seem significant, we still do it, right? Mm-hmm. And there, now, of course, those things reflect power relations and dynamics, and they will do that. And so you can't separate that out from the process, and sensitivity to that is what's motivating the kind of questions around authenticity and identity that have been around for a long time, frankly, but are reanimated in our current moment. And yeah, I guess my feeling about it is that I'm loath to try to police and shut it down. Like, that seems like maybe the less helpful impulse. I think what's more helpful is maybe to learn, like to encourage people to think critically about it. That I recommend. And there are definitely experiences in my life where white Minnesotans would just come up to me and start asking me questions about my chakras and like this. And it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And things that one could say are like racist in the philic, not phobic way, right?
Yeah.
Like
they're,
you know, which I also think is different, right?
I love your people.
Better. I love your people. Yeah. Yeah. Your hair is so beautiful. I want to touch it or whatever, like this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And sure, yes, there's racism and it's totally true. I would feel loath to like exploit and manipulate that kind of naive sentiment or whatever. But at the same time, what I would say is my desire to engage with and try to encourage someone to think more critically about their experience and knowledge is really relationship dependent. I mean, does the person have the trust with me to be able to listen to what I'd have to say about, you know, how you think about these things? And if I don't, I'm just going to be generous and nice and let people like work through whatever they want to work through and impose on me whatever they want to impose on me and go on my way. And one of the things I've really liked talking with you about when we've done it, not often enough, frankly, but is that Russ in particular, I mean, you've developed that kind of critical sort of sense of what this is that I'm doing, right? I mean, thinking about like the class politics of the Iyengars versus Ashtanga. And like, there's just a lot of shit to unpack in this stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you think of it as just mystical fantasy, Indian spirituality that's transcendent and makes your life meaningful and moves you to better places, you can have that. I don't want to rain on your parade. But if you want to do better and you want to think better about it, there are lots of things to learn. And people have thought a lot about these things. And you should, you know, like to think of it as a teacher, like a union organizer, to encourage critical awareness. We should do that with everything, right? Yeah. It's not unique to appropriation. Being a better community member in the world means like being sensitive to how things emerge and listening to people who are doing it and listening to people's contradictory feelings and experiences. But I, like I said, also policing these boundaries and having this kind of possessive investment in my culture, I don't feel like I'm in a place to do that with South Asian culture. Like I was just saying, like my relationship to it is partial and fragmented, and it would be weird. Yes, do I find it weird when non-South Asians participate in some of these cultural practices or mispronounce words or whatever it is? Sure. But like my feeling about it is I also mispronounce German or French. And I just want to approach this with a kind of charity and generosity that seems like a better way through this. Yeah. And at the same time, if you're trying to make some sort of political intervention around this, you should be really specific and concrete about what the task is, what you're trying to do. And one of the things that I find really frustrating in our identitarian moment is when people exploit this for personal, like it's a career advancement move, you know, like I'm using my identity to kind of actually compete in the field and push people out of my way. And I've seen that happen. And that's, I find that, well, it's not my way. I mean, I'm not going to stop people from doing that either, but, but it's not the way I approach things. So
I love that you mentioned French, because I had it right in my mind when you said it. I was thinking of Noam Chomsky's thoughts on language, say the French Academy, the effort to police how French is spoken. And yet you have areas of France that are very close to German. You have areas of French that are very close to Italian, and they speak French in a different way. And,
totally, yeah.
And what actually is the boundary of France at that point, except a fiction? I'm using that as a kind of context to think about the way in which I act in the world, which is as a term that I discovered that I liked and then appropriated for myself, was code switching. And,
oh, yeah, that's a good term.
And so I often find myself, and it's, our listeners will probably recognize that I'm not doing that with you. I'm not code switching into my New Orleans accent with you.
Oh, interesting.
I very often sink into that accent when I'm talking to someone who I think is in any way related to the South.
But he also doesn't have a New Orleans
no,
accent.
No, he doesn't.
So he's not bringing it out.
Yeah, I'm not bringing it out in you. Yeah.
Which I think also goes to your point that humans are constantly, we're constantly reflecting who we're surrounded by. And if as Westerners, we go to India and spend a lot of time there, it's totally natural and normal that we're going to
use our tongues differently.
Yeah. Say things differently or look at things differently or express ourselves differently or feel things. And as a Indian person generationally growing up in North America, it makes total sense that you feel so connected to American culture and music because it was so much a part of your experience. And so I think as the world becomes more and more global, there's so many more opportunities. Like, we're not just living in a little village and not going further than we can walk. We have the internet.
We're doing this right now, right?
Yeah, we can learn from teachers in China, Russia, France. We can connect in all kinds of different ways.
And I will inevitably try to sound like the person
in front of me. And so it's just so interesting that I think there's this expansiveness that's happening to us culturally. And people feel very threatened by it often. And that is also the movement towards this fascism, towards this, this is mine and I don't want it taken away or I hold it dear.
Nativism.
And it needs to be kept unchanging because the change is happening so fast and the exposure is happening at like exponential rates. And so there's a pushback in expressionism in that this is mine, not yours, and I don't want you to have it. That kind of like,
and I don't want you to change it either.
And I don't want you to change it. And you having it's going to change it. So there's like this whole tension, I think, that happens universally, and it happens to everyone, I think, in some in subtle ways or not so subtle ways. It's, I mean, it is interesting from a Marxist point of view. I don't know what the answer is, but maybe you do.
The Marxists would ask the political economy of these things, right? Like, where does the money flow? How does the system reproduce itself based on these sorts of exchanges? And again, like, that's where a lot of these questions are often not raised in a, I would say, in only a nativist fashion. Like, typically these questions are raised on the left, right? Like, the question of appropriation is a leftist question. It's the right that's saying, at least in the US, I'm not aware of everywhere, but the right, it's the US that people are saying things like, the holier than thou leftists are policing my ability to enjoy rap music or whatever, right? Like, that sort of thing as a white right wing person might say. And so my thought again is that if this is a conversation that the left is having, I just want the conversation to be nuanced and self-aware and self-critical and generally conducted within the spirit of what I hope the left should be, which is generous and tolerant, right? Yes, you can be intolerant of intolerance or what have you, but you have to, you actually have to, and the left actually does tolerate certain forms of intolerance. That's part of the story too. And there is a sense in which some of these forms of intolerance then, and I think maybe getting back to what you were alluding to, that flip over and become like related to or resonant with authoritarianism. And it's true that people on the left are also skeptical or critical of democracy and the sort of liberal capitalist state. I have my own critiques of it, but I also am worried about, unless you have something, enough political power and enough of a kind of program to imagine what would be better that would replace it, you're asking for a lot of trouble. And
we've seen that.
Yeah, what you get might be worse than the thing that you started with, right? And Marxism, maybe one of the important lessons of Marxism is it's a history of failures, right? It's a history of attempts to try to remake the world in a better place, often by force, and for both reasons of the power of the established system and classes, social forces that militate against it, plus its own self-imposed mistakes to the point of like violences and purgings and, you know, murder. I mean, you know, the left has done bad things. And one has to acknowledge that, I think, in order to figure out how do you do it better. And, you know, plenty of leftists, I'm not inventing any of this, right? But I do think that question, if it's a question of people who are not necessarily instinctively or politically allied to the far right, where I think the conversation has parallels but is different, then I think one has to figure out how to advocate for the values on the left that push the left to live up to the best of itself.
It also, something that you were saying was reminding me about, and I'm curious about, because in yoga, I know in India, you know, it's been used as a kind of a political tool in a lot of ways, like for independence, and even now to prop up Hindutva.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if music's also ever been used that way.
In India?
Totally.
No, like, oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, just universally.
Yes, definitely. I'm not an expert in like the music of the right, but there definitely have been many figures and composers engaged with the politics of the far right. Many people talk about Puccini's sort of flirtations with an ambiguous relationship with fascism. Richard Strauss had this complicated, problematic relationship to the Nazis. There were composers who were much more like pro-Nazi composers of the, say, like Fitzner or what have you, you know, who are composers who wrote interesting or compelling music. But so there's that in the classical music lineage. Yes. On average, I would say musicians who tend to be poor and tend to be, you know, kind of like many artists, not occupying elite strata, at least initially in their upbringing, tend to be sympathetic to the sort of ordinary person or the working people, at least in the sort of history of capitalism. And even prior, the patronage practices were often the wealthy who were like hiring poor artists to make something to celebrate the wealth of the aristocracy or the church or what have you.
And the sympathy towards patronage is exactly, that's important to a poor person.
It is, right? You have a complicated relationship to money and this thing is helping you survive. But it's also been the case that in those contexts, people will paint in or work in references that actually are critical of even their patrons or elites or what have you.
Right.
Michael Denning used to teach in one of his lectures of the architecture at Yale. And this is an elite institution run by New England WASP elites, right? That's the sort of history of the thing. Goes back to very old college. And in the sort of neo-Gothic, Gothic revival sort of architecture and like all these sort of friezes and sculptures that adorn many of the buildings, there are, because these things, many of them were done in the 20s and 30s, especially, they're like socialist references, like peppered in, almost hidden in, because, you know, these are workers who are class conscious, sort of like expressing in their own subtle way, a kind of resistance to the sort of power structure of the very institution that's employing them. And to go into, you know, the Indian context, which I know less about, but one of the things that my mom has been teaching me as part of, she's having more trouble with it now, but like in the last couple of years, she's been teaching me these Marathi songs, and they were like popular songs of the 50s, some were in Marathi films, some were in just played on the radio or whatever. And so she would sing them and I would learn the harmonium part. And then I sing them with her. She teaches me the words and we sing them together. And it's been really interesting. Some of these songs are really beautiful, but some of these figures like Sudhir Bhadke was one of them. I mean, these people were very attached to then the version of the Hindu far right that was like the seed of what we have today. My mother, they're all of my mother's castes, which are Konkanastha Brahmins. This caste was the same caste that includes Veer Savarkar, who was a key founder of the Hindu nationalist movement. His follower, Nathuram Godse, assassinated Gandhi. The like Indian and Maharashtrian sort of Hindu has like this lineage that kind of is not far from my family. My mom, I think, is related by marriage to Veer Savarkar. So that's the degrees of separation are not long. And so these musicians were also caught up in that. They were part of that. And they wrote beautiful songs that have implications that sometimes are weird, you know? And the more you know about it, I was talking with an ethnomusicologist who is also the same caste background as me at a conference in Austria that I was giving a talk at. Beth and I were both speaking there, and she's great. Her name is Rasika Jyotikar, I think. And she was describing, she said, oh yeah, all those people are all like full of this Hindu rite stuff. And so it's an and my parent, I think my mom, I don't know what my dad thinks. He's not as part of that because he's a different subcaste of Maharashtrian Brahmins who grew up in the south of India. Mm-hmm. Actually, were people who moved there because of Shivaji's conquering of the south, and Tanaji was down there. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of moved there with them to do administrative work. That's like his lineage. They're called Tanjore Maharashtrians. Mm-hmm. And then they're
not near Kerala at all. Not that far south.
Not there. No, more Madras, Chennai would be where.
On the east. Yeah. So I was just thinking about India is as far right nationalist and theocratic as it is, still has a communist state within it.
Yes.
Kerala, this is
and Bengal is also
Bengal as well.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. And it just shows, I think, that the hand of the state in India is not that powerful. They can't centralize the country in a way that you might do in a small, more culturally homogenous and maybe more developed and wealthier state or something. But yeah, you still have actually existing communism, you know, whatever, in Kerala. And a very good friend of mine who's an ecological justice activist and labor activist, he's a Malayali and he's been down there a few times and spent time trying to think about all the things one can learn from that world, which is amazing. And yes, you're absolutely right. And that's, I think, a part of the story of thinking about this kind of phenomenon is, I don't know, it's multi-layered complexity, you know, like it's contradictoriness. And that's when I'm singing or working on or thinking about these songs with my mom, that's the spirit in which I want to engage with it. And again, it also feels like an appropriation. I don't feel, I have the phonemes of Marathi in my head because I grew up with it. My mom's speaking it.
Right.
This is very foreign. I mean, I grew up again, listening to Indian classical music, like elements of it are there in my head, but also not. And when I hear my mom sing, she does these ornaments and little variations that, as not a strong singer as she may be, they're in her in a way, and they were in my grandmother in a way that they will never be in me. You know,
interesting.
People from outside have to learn that. You know,
I have a paragraph here in their question list, and I just want to get back to the music on your new album, "The Honor and the Glory of the Gated Community." There's a song. It's "To the Sea Once More." I was really taken with this song. There's something just so interesting that are happening in the intonations. Between you and Beth, you both seem to have a kind of extraordinary, authentic grasp of the intonations. And I was thinking about it, and I wrote down, I was thinking about it, like there's a kind of command there in the way that you would have, in Sanskrit, have a command over the placement of the tongue in terms of different D sounds or different the sounds. There's a Sanskrit word for those letters that I don't remember. But I want to play this song for our listeners.
I'm a child of eight who has lost my way. I afford no cause that I could not say, but I'd hold this close to my dying day till I knew that I'd found my home. Over land, when the breath is done. Over land, when I've left and run. Over land, when my death has come, I'll return to the sea once more. I was caught betwixt and between all things that my mother feared for a child who sings. But there'd be no cage nor a throne for kings when I knew that I'd found my home.
But there's a kind of nasalness to it that is maybe overlooked even in fucking Nashville, where they don't have a grasp over the authentic sound. But those, I don't know how to describe that.
Diphthongs.
Yeah. They're so wonderful. And Beth really has a command over it too. And I was wondering, is Beth from Minnesota or is she also from the South?
She's from Montana. And so there are three singers on the track. It's me first. And then Rosie is the one above me. And then Beth is the top one. And Rosie is from Minnesota. She grew up imitating the Dixie Chicks. That's how she and her sister acquired these incredible country voices. And then Beth, she's a classically trained singer, and she had to kind of learn it over time. And she's developed a really powerful one over the years. And so again, like, country music is an artifact of a practice that is like a fiction it's created, right? A kind of made up way of being and singing.
Yeah.
Nasal twang has roots in Scots-Irish singing practices and British Isles.
Or Bavarian yodeling.
Well, the yodeling too, yes. That's, which is also actually via minstrel troops that were doing it to satirize Bavarian yodelers. That's the that's how I think the Jimmy Rogers came across his yodel. And then there are African-American singing practices. There are indigenous singing practices that all, they all flow into this thing in weird, random ways. And so for country music to, country music is something that is so fundamentally inauthentic. It's a concocted, made-up genre that was a marketing, a racialized marketing genre invented in the 20s. Hillbilly was the kind of the designator. It's long been something that prides itself on this kind of authenticity and is significantly made up or invented at the same time. And so to me, like, there's something about it, in addition to its whiteness, even though it is like a kind of white working class practice, which gives me pause in my own imitation of it, I will say, it is still something that, you know, I'm participating in a kind of invention of tradition that isn't unique to me. Mm-hmm. And
are you familiar with the Saskatchewan country music artist Coulter Wall?
Yes. Not well, but I do.
He's come out on the scene with his extraordinarily gravelly country voice. His father is the Prime Minister of Saskatchewan, and I don't know if you've ever heard him talk.
No.
But he is white as cupcakes and is so Canada. Okay, you guys, so we are going to just talk about the administration of the funds in Saskatchewan. And then you've got his son, whose son is totally constructed himself. Now, he's awesome, and I love him. I love his music, but it's a total fiction.
It's a fiction, right? And so for me, I feel like from song to song, semi-consciously, I'm veering between what voice do I want? I'm not thinking that hard about it. Although when I want a country sound, I'm often like working through certain syllables with my bandmates about how I want something done. And with that song is such a strange song because the whole history of it is really bound up with a police murder of a person of color in the Twin Cities. Shortly, like months before George Floyd's murder, what happened was that, so this, the story is that there was Kobe Dimmock Heisler was a young, I can't remember, is mixed race, maybe man who was on the autism spectrum. And he was having a bad day and he was yelling at his grandparents where he was staying. And someone heard the yelling outside. They called the cops. Cops came in. They said he had a weapon. People say he didn't. And they shot him and they killed him. And I was asked to play because a dear friend of mine, Jadzia Sembla, is close to the family, asked us to play in a memorial event in the fall, September of 2019. And we, of course, agreed to do so. And we were thinking about what we would do in the performance other than our own songs. And I thought that, and I was inspired by the fact that Jadzia told me that Kobe loved sea shanties. And
which
I know relatively little about other than the cliches. Anyway, one morning, like not long before we were going to do this performance, I had this tune and I was thinking about sea shanties and thinking about Kobe and thinking about what we would do. And this tune was just circulating in my head. And I realized before I knew it, I was making up the song and I thought, oh, I'm writing a song right now. So then I started writing the words down. I made a demo of it. I had the parts. And then I taught it to Beth and Rosie. And we did like an a cappella version without the claps at the memorial. It was moving. People liked it. They sent it to the family. And then when we were in the studio, we recorded it. Rosie had the idea to do the slow claps and it really pulled it together. And then our recording engineer had us overdub parts. So that's us doing it. It's all unedited. Basically, a couple of the claps are edited because they're for timing. We screwed them up. But the vocals are basically unedited, but they're superimposed. And so it sounds like this kind of old time choir or something because of the superimposition of parts. But that was the kind of genesis of it. And so this To the Sea Once More is about like returning to the sea and also like returning home, which is about returning, like dying. And it's about this kind of trying to imagine this journey towards home, towards some space for this kid, having gone through what he went through. Yeah. So that's the, it's a very, intense thing to think about how it all unfolded, and an intense way to start an album, and it resonated very much with everything that's happened since.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing that you said about realizing that you're writing a song. And it's so critical for an artist to realize that they're having that moment of inspiration. Because so often you could just daydream it away and forget that it happened. But you're like, oh shit, this is happening right now. And you have to go and find paper to write the thing down. And then Yes. Maybe work with that idea later. Maybe there's a way to develop it. But if you don't, it's gone. And you have to remember Yes. To do it. That's so beautiful.
Yes. Well, it's very related to the fact that one of the things that's happened over the last several years is I've started to dream songs and then remember them. And so the first one that really stood out to me was Georgia on our second album. And I was having this bizarre dream where essentially I was in the house of someone who had died, and I was wandering around the space, and I see this corpse on an old bed, and I walk over to the next room, and I'm in a movie theater, and the credits of the film are rolling, and this song is being sung by Joan Baez and Leonard Cohen. And it's just the acoustic guitar, the bass part, and those two voices. There's like maybe a verse, and then it's all that, oh, take a midnight train way down to Georgia, which is obviously coming from Gladys Knight in the Pits, right? Yeah, but it's all Georgia. Mixed up. Yeah.
Or Willie Nelson's A Rainy Night in Georgia. Had Leonard Cohen just died when that song was written, or was it before that or after?
I think before he died.
Oh, yeah, it was before. Yeah. The album is, I was going to play Divorce Dress, but Georgia is, because it really, like, when you sent me this album, and I really so grateful that you did, and now you have a habit of sending them to me, which is fantastic. Whoa. But it was like, I received it and I was like, this old friend from high school is now making the music that I like. And it was like, it was revelatory, and it was so felt and so lived. And it was so very different from the classical musician that I knew, who is now this. And I'm just so taken with your career and the arc of your life. And I think you're amazing. And thank you for honoring us with your esteemed presence on the show. And I know your time is very valuable, but I'm happy to.
I'm touched to have you have me. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you so much for letting us into your world. And I think that's often what we think about this podcast, that it is that. It's like each unique one is an entire universe. And there's a lot more here for us to dig into and talk to. And I hope we get the chance.
I would love to. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Wasn't it fun? I loved it. Oh my gosh, so good. If you didn't know, we have an open community, Finding Harmony Community. It's hosted over on Mighty Networks, and I want to invite you to join. It is a place where we have discussions. You can also practice with me once a month, some pranayama, some breathwork practices. We have challenges and meditation groups and conversations about the podcast. You can also make suggestions for guests that you would like us to interview, as well as just talk about what you're learning or what you're noticing, not just in the podcast, but in your practice, in your life. It's a beautiful online community, and I'm curating it on Mighty Networks, and it's open for all of our listeners, so that's you. I hope that you come on over and join us. It's a great group of human beings, heart-centered humans that are all interested in spiritual practices, Ashtanga yoga, coaching, personal development, growth, meditation, breath work. We're really diving into how to deepen our spiritual practice beyond just the obvious and infuse our spiritual practice into everyday life. How we can find harmony within ourselves, within our lives, and bring it out into the world. So I would love for you to join my Finding Harmony community. You'll find the link in our show notes here.
and also in my bio on Instagram. I can't wait to welcome you in and get to know you more and have you be a part of this great group of human beings who are all finding harmony in different ways within themselves and within the world.
That's it. We've concluded another episode of the Finding Harmony podcast. I just want to thank you so much for doing the work that changes the world, starting with yourself. It truly does make a huge difference. Please make sure you have your automatic downloads turned on wherever you listen so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. I have so much more magic I can't wait to share with you. Lastly, if you're on Instagram, I love connecting and hearing from you. So come on over and say hello at Finding Harmony Podcast. And you can also come say hello to me personally at Harmony Slater Official. Thank you again for being here. I cannot wait to share more with you in our next episode.